Wednesday, May 17th, I was up early, little after 7, and at my mail, and then at 11 o'clock, the first appointment of the day was in the Kennedy Garden with the multiple sclerosis people. The group included representatives of the board, pianist and humorist, who was presenting me with the bronze hope chest, and Richard Jacoby, the multiple sclerosis man of the year, in a wheelchair, a victim of the disease since 59, but still working, and with ironic appropriateness, in the Health, Education, and Welfare Department, and of course, a phalanx of press and cameras. It was the most hilarious presentation that ever happened to us. Victor Borgia had been warming them up, I heard later, with such remarks as, when someone asked where I was, "She's on the other side cutting the grass." And when asked if he was going to introduce me to the Jacobies, "I will if I can remember her name." He got through the actual presentation with good enough grace, but at the end he began to cough. As I made my thanks to the volunteers and the researchers and the hope for the future that work held out, and he coughed worse and worse, getting red in the face, and everybody began to laugh, and I never knew whether it was real or staged. At any rate, Mr. Jacoby and his wife were as amused as anyone, which was all that mattered. I insisted that they have a private tour upstairs, if they wanted to. Meanwhile, we had been subject of great interest to all the tourists who were filing by on the other side of the glass in the corridor, some 4 or 5 abreast. It must have looked ridiculous to them, all of us just bending over with laughter around this poor man in the wheelchair. I signed and dictated and autographed until it was time to go to Evie Symington's for lunch, and this, indeed, was an offbeat, different, delicious thing for me. A few friends, its only purpose fun. I love the aura of Evie and Stu's house in Georgetown. It's an old revolutionary house, and once she told me that there was a tunnel down in the basement that ran down to the river, and it was used during the Civil War as a part of the so-called Underground Railroad, an escape route for slaves. There's a sort of charm there that comes only from generations of good taste, the stamp of a family over 100 years at least. There's a Botticelli over the mantel, a stern Dutch face that looks like it might have been painted by Frans Hall, a delicate Andrea del Sarto drawing as you go up the stairs, and most charming of all, a portrait of a little girl about 7. It was Evie's mother, and an elegant woman in a wedding dress of the 1890s, I would judge. There were 6 of us, Carol Fortas and Libby Rowe, Mary Ellen Monroney and Marnie Clifford. If I had planned it for my own special pleasure, there couldn't have been people I would enjoy more. We had a drink, and it the middle of the day, feeling very abandoned, and delicious bits of conversation. I remember Evie talking about how when she was a little girl of 11 or 12, and her mother had a dinner party planned with the oysters all arranged properly on the plates, and she was in the pantry, loved oysters, and went around from plate to plate, glup, 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 with an oyster off each plate, never dreaming that she'd be caught. The story came into the hands of Mrs. Longworth, and she's never heard the end of it. Carol and I sat on a sofa and talked about the Society for a More Beautiful Capital. I lean on her, just as I do on Abe, for wisdom and advice. We talked about the common market and the British bid to get in and the French. And of the French, she said, they are good dressmakers and painters. Libby Rowe was just back from her trip to London, where she had gone with her husband just for fun. They had taken a car and found the little roads and explored the countryside. And one place she had been to was the home of Beatrix Potter, who wrote the Peter Rabbit books and all the adorable little books that I read to Linda and later to Lucy, and that Linda has now had rebound in leather and cherishes, crayon marks and all. Tabitha Twitchett and Mrs. Tickettwinkle were part of our life. They said that Beatrix Potter's home was still there, and Mr. McGregor's farm, and all the pretty countryside where her characters lived. Every time another farm came up for sale, Beatrix Potter would write another children's book and buy the farm. And when she died, she left all her holdings, some 4,000 acres, to the National Trust. so that it could remain just as it was, beautiful countryside for generations of children to enjoy. I thought of Linda and what a good story that would make for her to write. We ate off Lewistop, a very delicious feminine sort of lunch, including delicious eggs in some jellied mixture. And the talk ranged wide and was full of laughter, and 3 o'clock came very soon. I left. Back at the White House, continued my self-indulgence by having an hour's nap, and then had a Spanish lesson in preparation for tomorrow, when I'll be seeing all the diplomat wives at tea, and then dressed in my very favorite outfit, the champagne lace, for the last of the big receptions, the military. 1,200 had been invited. We expected possibly 1,000. Hopefully we'd begun to put up the striped booths in the lawn this morning. I love it when there are blue skies and crisp white summer uniforms and snapping flags and striped tents for refreshments and the red-coated Marine band. But this has been a cold, gray spring. Not once have we had the beautiful drama of a lawn party. So we met the guests of honor upstairs in the yellow room, the Vice President and the McNamaras, and the 4 special guests of honor, the Medal of Honor winners, Captain Barnum and a nice-looking young Negro, Lawrence Joel, with his wife, who was as dressed up and as thrilled at being here as I would have been at her age, and Lieutenant Marm, and a Captain Williams, who brought his wife and talked to Landon about their 4-year-old daughter, who had been present at the ceremony when her father was awarded the medal, and whom Lyndon had immediately taken to, and she to him. And now, every time Lyndon comes on television, this little girl, said her parent, walks up and kisses his face on the set. The top brass was upstairs, General Wheeler, General McConnell of the Air Force, but for the rest of the services, acting chiefs of operations. And, of course, the Secretary of the Army, Mr. Rezor, and the Secretary of the Navy, Mr. Nitze. Since the Defense Department went under one head, these high offices have retreated into relative obscurity. I was delighted that Senator Margaret Chase Smith was upstairs with us. I think any honor or dignity accorded her, and this was because of her rank on the Armed Services Committee, is highly appropriate. This time, a receiving line was just too much, so we went downstairs for pictures in the Blue Room with the Medal of Honor winners and their wives and the Vice President and others with General and Mrs. Wheeler. And then we began to make the circle, where indeed there was plenty of low brass as well as high brass, the guests ranging from stewards to Lyndon's valets, the personnel of Camp David and of the Sequoia, and communications people who go with us to the ranch, to 64-star generals and 1 5-star general, Omar Bradley, and his recent bride, very much the center of attention. And I was eager to see her because Mary Ellen had told me so much about how happy the general was. He looked it, just beaming. One writer said the state dining room looked like the subway at rush hour. She was right, and as I made my way through it, I kept on saying to guests, I hope you'll find a plate or a drink and your favorite friends and go out on the porch. The view is lovely. Or find a seat in the red room or the green room. Many did. But wherever Lyndon went, like the Pied Piper, a crowd swelled around him. He shook hands to right and left, and so did I, in slower tempo, and we circumnavigated the state dining room, and then the Blue Room, and then I drifted out onto the porch. By that time, I didn't see him any longer, and I was in the East Room. There were buffets and bars in both the state dining room and the East Room, and dancing in the East Room. Chief Baltimore, Chief Mills, and the other 2 chiefs and their wives were there. Our one-time aide, the Howard Burrises, looking very handsome, both of them. I met one general's wife named Mrs. Reedy, who had been at the University of Texas with me in 1932. She remembered Nell Colgan. She'd been a Pi Phi. Some vague bell in the recesses of my mind rung when she called her maiden name. The many guests who'd been stationed at San Antonio sometime, clustered around the chili con queso dip. There was one moment when I found myself going through a doorway, and there, planted firmly in the center of it, was a large, formidable-looking woman in a festive Tyrolean costume. Lyndon was right behind me. Mr. President, will you do something for me? Always the greeting most calculated to make me, at least, want to melt into the furniture. It was the Baroness von Trapp from Vermont. Too slowly to make a deft introduction, my mind clicked into the recollection that Senator Aiken had suggested it would be nice if we invited her. She's his constituent down visiting Washington. She wanted to go to Vietnam, taking, as well as I could gather, the movie Sound of Music, the story of her life, for the servicemen to see, and she wanted the president to intercede for her with McNamara. Do you have an influence with Mr. McNamara? Lyndon, who is quicker than I, said, no, but my wife does, and away he went. For 2 hours, I both worked at it and enjoyed it. Going upstairs a little past 8 to join the Cecil Burneys, who were our house guests for the night, and Herman Jones, who's in town for an alcoholics board, and whom we had added to the reception and invited to stay for dinner with us. It was only then that I realized how tired I was. It is physically great exertion for me, just like plowing or mountain climbing, to give out, to try to be pleasant, to think of a point of contact with 1,000 people. I hope it does not show in my face or demeanor, because I want to always remember that this may be the only time some of them will be here, see this house, see a president or first lady, and for some of them, it will be as thrilling as it was for me when I was 26. There followed 2 pleasant, relaxed hours. Cara Burney had prepared for me a list of names of Latin Americans who were outstanding for some contribution, cultural or economic or government, in South Texas. It is hard for us to keep current, to bring in new names, new blood, to invitations to committees, to add their strength to our personal and political life. Cecil showed me a delightful picture of a big complex of automobile sales businesses where hundreds of palm trees had been planted around the several-acre establishment, and a small sign, charmingly designed, said, Lady Bird, we don't think there's anything man-made more beautiful than our cars, but we agree that cities should be made beautiful, and we're trying. I was pleased at the yeast, the vitality of the idea of conservation, beautification, and of the use this place I'm in can be put to as a forum, a point of leadership. We had Lyndon's favorite Creole shrimp plus party food. The guests left about 11:30, and Lyndon went to night reading, and I to bed with my current book. I was delighted that he had told Herman Jones that he wanted to appoint Bess to the first vacancy on the Committee on Retardation. She will work well and ably, along with Muriel, Matilda, and the other capable people there. I am glad when we can put our mark on these committees and commissions. The eternal difficulty is always in finding the right person.